Welcome to Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy and I'm a careers consultant here in DCU Career Service. This week we're meeting Mary Van Lieshout, who is Deputy CEO and Director of External Affairs for Goal. So thank you very much for joining us today, Mary. And first of all, maybe you could start off by explaining who and what Goal are all about.
Well, thanks, Siobhan, for having me on. I'm delighted to speak to the students of Dublin City University and its staff. I'm an alumni of Dublin City University, so always proud to be associated with it. GOAL is, as you've said, an international non-governmental agency. We are 42 years young now, and we were established over 40 years ago by a sports journalist, an icon in Ireland named John O'Shea. And John had traveled to India and was deeply moved by the poverty that he encountered there, young children living on the streets in Calcutta. And John came back and rallied his friends to set up a fund to transfer money and support and medical help to the very deeply impoverished people of India. Today, we carry that mission on. We continue to work with some of the most isolated, hard-to-reach communities across the globe. We're working in 14 countries now. We have a reach, starting as a family business in those meager but passionate years in terms of our early development. We're now today 2,400 staff strong. We spend over 125 million euro of donor money trying to assist and collaborate and partner with communities on their journey out of poverty towards long-term sustainable livelihoods in which they enjoy the rights which all of us as citizens of our planet should enjoy. So our work encompasses things like providing supports and partnership around healthcare, around livelihoods. We also work deeply in the area of water, emergency supports, being health or water or livelihood supports. So a range of initiatives helping people at that time of crisis and often staying with communities as they rebuild their communities and rebuild their lives family by family.
That's fantastic. Just some of the things that I was very much struck by, that this kind of, and I think it's how the NGO sector, I suppose, has developed over a number of years, that it's kind of much more of an emphasis of sustainability within those communities that you're working with. So then they are able to be more self-sufficient. So it's not always about just emergency aid. It's about more long-term engagement. I mean, some of the countries that you're involved with, you must be there for a long number of years now at this point.
Sure. You're absolutely right, Siobhan, that everyone's focus, no matter what point of entry they have as an NGO in a community, the vast bulk of NGOs are interested in ensuring that what they contributes to sustainable, resilient outcomes for the communities in which we work. So we entered Haiti on foot of the hurricane there. We enter a community on foot of any type of emergency, and we can stay for decades, insofar as some of our work then transmutes into long-term development work with communities. But let's face it, development isn't linear. And that's one of the most important lessons, I think, for students of international relations and global development. We grew up, or we may have grown up in my era, thinking there's a crisis and then there's an intervention and then communities come out another end. For very many communities, you know, this fragility is very cyclical. Today we have conflict and climate change impacting communities across the global south, and we see a continuation or a cycle of vulnerability. So sometimes we're staying in a location, not because we've moved our programming towards long-term development as much as the cycle of fragility just continues to impact. And we have to rethink, what are the interventions? What are the points in the system in which these communities live that need to be strengthened, that need attention, so that their environment, including the public policy environment, is such that they can sustain the recovery that we hope we are part of. So I think we do have a much more complex understanding of the issue of development and poverty. And today, as I say, this isn't about a disaster we can't see. Climate change is all around us. It's impacting our communities with whom we work much more disproportionately than it is impacting in the global north. And indeed, those communities have so far less with which to cope, to respond, and they have done so much less to create the crisis that the injustice of the climate crisis is palpable when you're working with communities in the global south.
As an organization such as GOAL, you know, we often, you know, look at other sectors and, you know, we talk about, you know, their mission and their vision and their strategy. And so, you know, if we're somewhere like GOAL where you may have a particular strategy, there is also an agility that's needed maybe to respond. Or how do you manage that difficult space between, you know, how do you stay true to, you know, your mission and vision and also be responsive? It must be kind of quite challenging at times.
It certainly is. Agility is a core competency here in GOAL. The COVID-19 has tested that like no other crisis that we've encountered, insofar as this wasn't a crisis, as all of your listeners know, this wasn't a crisis that just affected one country, which is often it's a large challenge in and of itself to understand what's the appropriate intervention in one country. Mm-hmm. This was a crisis that affected every single one of our countries and also affected, of course, us in the global north. So it affected donors. It affected us here in GOAL headquarters in Dunleary. It affected every single one of our country teams. And yet we were able to move our programming very quickly because we have that history of emergency response. Emergency response means that we are constantly investing in ensuring that we are prepared for any range of emergencies that could transpire in a community or in a region. And that means a regular annual and more often than annual investment in risk assessment. What are the risks facing any community? What are the preparations we would need if one of those risks came to fore, be they political instability that could impact on social protection measures in any country, to a natural disaster that could be foreseen because we can see so much through the climate analysis. So in GOAL in particular, where humanitarianism and emergency response are our key and core values, we do pride ourselves on our agility. We pride ourselves that we have reached, with our COVID response, over 17 million people in our countries with messaging, with water, with clean water, with soap, with masks, with health services that were protected and delivered in a way that supported governments in reducing the transmission of this infection. So our teams did very well. We built a lot on our experience of Ebola in Sierra Leone and Guinea a few years ago. We learned a lot from that experience. We were a key player, a key partner of USAID, of the Irish government, of the UK government in Sierra Leone, where we led out and stationed a large Ebola treatment center. It was a very challenging time. Ebola was much more lethal than COVID is, and so very frightening type of work, which needs really courageous individuals on the front line. But we learned a lot from that experience that we took into our response to COVID. So agility, it can often be understood as just being fast. We are fast, but we really need to be informed by the evidence of what works. And that takes a huge amount of preparation. So the word can be a little bit misleading. We're agile, but it has to be evidence-based kind of interventions built on knowledge of what works. And, one of the key things, just in summary on that, that we learned in Sierra Leone was some of the early interventions around Ebola, which were very heavy-handed, talking down at communities about the transmission of Ebola, telling communities what to do with a loved one who was ill or a loved one who had died of Ebola, telling them what to do as opposed to appreciating the complexity of that process. We learned a lot that communities rejected those early messages, and Ebola threatened to swamp many communities, much more so than it did. But it was because NGOs, both Sierra Leonean NGOs and international NGOs, came to learn that unless the communities were at the center of the answer to Ebola, were at the center of deciding this, how a funeral would take place, unless they were consulted and drove those answers, we were not going to succeed in fighting Ebola. And we learned that with COVID. Communities are at the center of goals response. We asked communities, how will they cope with funerals? How many people should be here? What kind of supports do they need in terms of hand washing facilities, et cetera, to make sure that they would use what was provided? So the agile nature of our work should not belie the complex nature of it and how deeply involved communities are in driving it.
That's fascinating. And I suppose when you do touch on Ebola, and I liked the idea that you spoke about agility, but it was an awful lot about evidence-based around that agility. You see, because a lot of things around agility can be interpreted, just keep throwing resources at it and something will stick and it'll work. But, it's not in anyone's business, never mind an NGO sector, that's just not a feasible, approach, and it's about kind of digging deep and working, looking at what could be the smarter way to look at things and test things out. I'm just curious about the your work about the with Ebola. Can I take it that Ebola isn't quite gone away though? I mean, it is under control, but is where are we with that?
Ebola has certainly not gone away. In fact, Gold is just introducing, is supporting an intervention in Guinea as we speak. Ebola has resurfaced in many communities in Central and Western Africa over the many years since it was first discovered in the late 1970s. So Ebola has not gone away. And in some communities, I would suggest, and I should be careful here, I would suggest that our response in Guinea, our ability to work with communities there to combat it, will be slightly more straightforward based on the work we did in Sierra Leone. But Ebola is in some countries, Central African Republic, some of the parts of the Congo, where conflict and displacement and the fragility of the communities really makes it much, much more difficult to mount an effective response. And so I'm very conscious of not wanting to pretend that Ebola has gone away or that indeed we won't continue to deal with it in many communities. But as I say, some communities, we thought we would see a large outbreak. There was some thinking there would be a large outbreak in and around some of the countries in Eastern Africa this year or last year, and we didn't see that resurface. The prevention mechanisms moved in very quickly, the mitigation mechanisms. So we continue to see it in some parts of Africa, there's no doubt.
Brilliant. Can you just maybe speak about your current role and what that means, because you're a deputy CEO and involved in external affairs, maybe to unpack what that means. And then we might just go back into your own career history, or whichever way you want to do it first. I'm open to whatever way you want to tell your own story. That would be very powerful for us to hear how you came to the position you're in right now.
Okay, well, I am, as you say, deputy CEO, deputy to Siobhan Walsh, who is our chief executive officer. And that means I have a lot of responsibility supporting Siobhan in the overall organization and implementation of the business. I don't want any of your listeners to not appreciate that the work of a non-governmental agency now is very purposeful. We are driven by our humanitarian mission, but it's a business. It's a large business, and we need to mind it. We need to steward it carefully on behalf of our board. We need to steward it carefully on behalf of our donors. So we have 8 or 10 business functions. My specific business function that I manage is external affairs, and that means I manage a team of our communications team. I manage the number of functions that have an external facing responsibility of communicating goals, mission, and its impact, and to bringing partners with us. So the specific functions reporting to me today are our communications team, who have a responsibility in using the media, both traditional and social media, at communicating goals impact within the communities that we work, and bringing those stories to life, and bringing the individuals who collaborate with us and with whom we partner into the public discourse. So that's the communications team. We have a global citizenship team, which works through bringing those stories of the lives of our communities where we work to traditional formal sector populations. So we have a development education team. We have a team that works with young people. So I would welcome anyone of your listeners who's interested in joining our youth engagement program, where we work with young people in Ireland and young people abroad at creating resources for our DevEd team. We feel the most successful way at talking about development to young people and to not so young people is to make sure that these resources are developed not in our headquarters, but are developed with and in partnership with people from our communities with whom we work. So we have a youth engagement program just kicking off now for the next year, which has 30 individuals, 15 from Ireland and 15 from 5 countries with whom we work. And these will all be energetic, highly inspirational youth leaders who will be developing tools and teaching materials for the work that we do in our development education programs. So it's a really neat cyclical process of bringing the voice deeply into the curriculum here in Ireland. And the third part of our global citizenship work is our advocacy work. And that also reports into me. And that's about our relationship with influential leaders in Ireland and policymakers. Our large advocacy piece of work this year is around Syria. Your listeners will probably be aware that the conflict engulfing Syria is now in its 10th year. Many people working in this conflict think this has never been worse. The situation in northwest Syria, the over 4 million people, many of whom are displaced from other parts of the country into a county the size of Galway. GOAL works in this area, the northwest of Syria. There's a peace agreement right now. It's very fragile. This situation shows very little signs of a political agreement, which will bring some respite to the communities in that area. So we've been bringing our message to the Joint Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs and Defense. We've been working with our team and with leaders in Brussels this week alone on a pledging conference where we've been arguing for larger investment and political settlement that would bring some peace to this conflict-torn area. A whole generation of children, a child who's 10 years has grown up knowing nothing but conflict. in this part of the world. We need that to stop. And that's been that would be an example of our advocacy work. The other teams that I manage include our monitoring and evaluation teams. And a lot of people, I think, from your courses are interested in monitoring and evaluation. That's my understanding from the kind of, I sit on a lot of interview boards, and so I see a lot of interest. This is the team of people who go in and teach our program staff how to measure their effectiveness, how to monitor to make sure if we say we are supporting a community with a certain type of intervention, we go into that community after the intervention and we do interviews with the community. We monitor that if there's a quantitative objective, so many trainings were held, we monitor that those trainings were indeed held, and we set before and after targets. And it's our monitoring and evaluation team that helps us understand, did we reach those targets? And if not, why not? And that's very much a part of our story that we bring not only to donors, but to the public through our website and through our learning papers. So those three teams come into me as I set the strategy for what are the messages we need to bring, who are our key external stakeholders, and how do we package that message to make sure that it's coherent and inspires our donors and your listeners, indeed.
That's fantastic. So I suppose I was really very much struck, and I'm very glad you brought it up around, you know, like that this goal, and all NGOs and developmental organizations, you know, they have all of the business functions of a regular business. They have HR, they have finance, the operations, obviously on your side, logistics must be a huge part of some of the work that you do. And then obviously there's, you know, might be different terminology associated, you know, like you might be talking about programs, another company would be talking about a product or a service, you know what I mean? So it's the same thing, just using a different, more, I suppose, appropriate language for the sector that you're in. So if you could just maybe bring us back through your own career story, you know, how you started off and how you had, you always an interest in this area, or was there a little bit of serendipity on the way?
Well, let me say my first degree, my early interest in life, I had an early interest in global poverty. My parents were very formative in that regard. So my father was a medical practitioner. My mother was a nurse, and I had many siblings, but I was always struck by, you know, his, in particular, my father's sense of mission, about global poverty. Like so many, I grew up in the United States, but like so many, students here, we had missionaries who would come in. We gave during Lent to support individual children abroad. Those things, those initiatives captured my imagination from a very young age. That doesn't mean there was no serendipity along the way, because I certainly have been, I believe, extremely privileged in being able to work in this sector. But let me say that after I graduated from high school, another really deep love of mine was food and nutrition. And so I channeled my interest into becoming a public health nutritionist and working abroad. I studied nutrition in university, and shortly thereafter, I volunteered to go abroad with the church, and I was placed with a Catholic mission, on a Catholic mission at a very young age, in 1983 in Zimbabwe. It was 2 or 3 years out of independence at that time. So I was associated with a Catholic mission hospital, which had, within weeks of me arriving, and between my undergraduate degree, I spent a year at London School of Tropical Hygiene, where I studied international and tropical malnutrition under a very famous doctor, Dr. Morley, David Morley. And it was really an exciting opportunity. I volunteered to work in the library to be able to sit on classes and audit them, you know, and just and learn. And I met many people coming to and from missions and program work abroad in that year. So that gave me some preparation, I would say. It gave me some knowledge of what I might encounter that would be different than what a nutritionist in the United States of America would encounter. But it by no means equipped me for the level of responsibility that I was given. And I want to distinguish that because I do a fair bit of trying to work with students who are interested in this field to try to contrast what the scenario was when I was very young. I'm at the end of my career almost. So 40 years ago, it was very much the case that, might I say, ill-equipped individuals could find their way into positions of authority. And now I don't want to overstate it. There was a hospital administration, and of course I didn't run the hospital, but I felt, I look back at it now, and I realize, you know, the decisions I was being offered would intimidate me terribly now as an older professional, as a more seasoned professional. And today I would say to your listeners, to those who want to engage in our sector, it's a journey. We do not take people like me any longer. The NGO sector has grown up. We've had some experiences as a sector and, you know, that have grown us up quite abruptly, let me say. And the sector today is a business. There's no getting away. As I say, it's purpose-driven. It's a very fulfilling business. But we take ourselves, and rightly so, we take the communities whom we serve very seriously. And we serve them right by only sending people, if we do have to send an international person, that brings added value. The vast majority of skills that are involved in much of what we do can be secured locally. Ethiopia, Uganda, these are countries who have excellent universities. And many more. The skills that we have and that we bring from our international experience are really the vast minority of people that we have today on staff. We have 2,400 staff, and we have about a small fraction of those are citizens of the global north. The vast majority of our staff, if I said 150 international staff compared to citizens of the global south leading our programs, you know, it's a small fraction. And that's right, because the solidarity that's required, the long-term solution that is required, is that the citizens of the global south drive their own development, drive their own engines of recovery. And so that's correct that they're at the forefront of it. But getting back to my path, I found myself in Zimbabwe for 3 years. I came to Ireland on the basis of a relationship that I made there, and that has, you know, been, and Ireland became my home, has been my home ever since. I studied when I came back from Africa, more fully appreciating the need to further equip myself professionally. I did a master's in community health and general practice at Trinity College. And following that, I found myself in Oxfam, Ireland. I spent 10 years working for Oxfam, Ireland, a combination of my experience in understanding programming and field work and my passion for communication. I became the campaigns manager at Oxfam, Ireland, where we undertook, you know, the kind of campaigns I described about Syria. But in those days, some of your listeners will appreciate the Khmer Rouge was a nefarious actor in Cambodia, and yet by some, you know, due to politics, they held the seat at the United Nations. And that was one of our early campaign matters, was to ensure that the people of Cambodia at the UN were not represented by those who had been authors of so much destruction. So that's an example of the kind of campaigning that was relevant then and would still be relevant now. Indeed. So I spent 10 years working with Oxfam Ireland. I am a parent. I have 3 children, and I found that the level of travel that is associated with this kind of work was, from my point of view, incompatible with my children growing into their adolescence. And so I took a detour. I went and took my campaigning work to what was then known as the Eastern Health Board. I became director of health promotion, where I spearheaded some campaigns on smoking and in workplaces and helping to eradicate that. So again, this combination for me of advocacy work, communications, largely in the health field. That's my original grounding, and that's where I feel the most comfortable. I went from there to, I spent some time, 10 years again, I spent 10 years at the National Disability Authority as head of standards and research, trying to do research on, you know, a domestic equality issue, which has been a theme for me, you know, this equality agenda. And I worked then on the inclusion of people with disabilities and standards and regulation that would encourage the mainstreaming of people with disabilities into our social services, as an example, and the systems that support them, and independent living. But I knew when I my children and my family and my, you know, situation grew, I decided when I was at the National Disability Authority, I really want to go back into the humanitarian field. It is my love. And I then decided that the best preparation for that would be to do a master's in international relations at Dublin City University. Many people recommended DCU. I recommend it to very many people. The School of Law and Government there, I think, is just top notch. I had top notch lecturers, excellent group of people with whom I studied for 2 years. I found it very formative. It took the passion that I had and put some theory behind it. It helped me challenge some of my own ill-conceived, you know, passions and opinions and prejudices. And I was able to read widely in those 2 years at that course. I will always be grateful for it. Always be grateful for the teachers I met. I think I still say, whether I'm right or wrong, DCU has the best international relations course in the country. I still say that to many people because I feel I was so much better equipped when I started to look in the humanitarian field for what I would bring to it. I was so much better equipped by the 2 years I spent at DCU. And that brings me to GOAL. I joined GOAL as the head of monitoring and evaluation because I have a research background along the way. I moved from that to a position of leadership on the senior management team a few years ago, where I took up the head of ethics and compliance. And that was really a mix of my commitment to, you know, my background in regulation with the National Disability Authority, and a passion for growing this business and course correcting to make sure that our business was fit for purpose. And we implemented a whole range of initiatives to strengthen GOAL in a few years. And from that, I joined the leadership team as deputy CEO to the new CEO when she started a few years ago. It's been a real privilege that I get up every single day and can not only, you know, see a different range of commitments ahead of me and responsibilities, but to love it. To love it and to believe very fundamentally that the work of GOAL, the work of the agency I serve and that I support, is doing such good work. And so it is a real privilege to work in this sector. So I would do anything to help good people come into our sector and to prepare for it.
That's absolutely brilliant, because I think once we can see the narrative of other people and their various career stories, and just at the time you took an opportunity to do this or do that, in at that time you don't know always where it's going to lead to, but you know, just in the doing it can move you on to the next step. But we have to know that when we put out that next step, we don't always know where our feet are going to land, but you have to kind of trust each decision as you come through it. And if it keeps in, and I touching in on your own values. And I think that can be a great, I suppose, reference guide. Is it in keeping with your sense of purpose? Is it in keeping with your core values and your own internal mission in life? I think that can be kind of just help you, I suppose, sort out, you know, kind of your thoughts around whether, you know, one step in your career is any better than another. We all have to take a risk from time to time. So that is really, really powerful. One of the things that you mentioned a couple of times now since that we started this episode is that whole concept of being a professional now within this this very important, you know, sector. But I'd like maybe to talk about the role of the volunteer. And I suppose I'm also quite mindful of, say, students at the moment or early graduates, you know, or even experienced professionals, you know, who might be in jobs that might be able to take a sabbatical, or, you know, they might be in a position that, you know, like teaching or something, that they might have some time off during the summer, and just kind of how to explore that role of a volunteer, and obviously particular emphasis in how GOAL manages their volunteer program.
Okay, we have just lately actually looked at our volunteer program and said, oh, we need to put some better structure around this, because we get the kind of volunteer that GOAL gets is a person generally who is coming to help us with our domestic work here in Ireland. We do not have a sending program for volunteers abroad for the kind of reasons I've talked about in terms of the skill sets that we're looking for when we hire somebody. But we do have an intern program where we get, and this 2 years ago we started, or 3 years ago, I think we started a partnership with your School of Languages. We've just had a researcher working with us on looking at how important is translation in GOAL's work. And that was fascinating, because it sounds like, of course we translate our things, but the nuances in some of the complex areas that we work, and you know, the kind of functions that we have, were really fascinating when a specialist came in and looked at it. So we take researchers as interns, and we take people who are doing research, and we send them abroad as interns, often on a very structured program where they may be doing research under one of our program leaders into one of our functions. And as you said, I mean, this is a business, so we can take interns into our human resources function who might go abroad with us and do training on some new policy that's been developed or new mechanism to strengthen our HR functions. We could take interns into our logs program during COVID. You know, we were purchasing protective equipment just like the rest of the world. And it was a massive effort to try to get enough PPE to our teams abroad. Our logs team was working flat out to try to find a market where we could that we could source to make sure that our staff and our community, you know, the communities we worked with, were safe. So we would take interns into any of those functions because we think we can help develop them. They can help us get some business done, and we contribute to strengthening the sector through an intern program. So our volunteers are more likely to be folks who help us with our fundraising. We have a GOAL mile every Christmas.
Yes.
Last year it was virtual, but we have a volunteer supporter network. If any of them are listening, it's my obligation to tell them how deeply they are appreciated for the work they do for us every Christmas. The GOAL mile has to be the most enjoyable fundraising event I've ever been to, because it's a community event. It's 1 mile. Almost everyone can enjoy it, and yet the money is so necessary and yields such positive results for our communities. So we really enjoy it, and that's led entirely by volunteers who give tirelessly of their pre-Christmas weeks to organize these things. So that's kind of a mix. Our volunteer program is mostly here in Ireland. Our intern program can be here, people sitting within our desks here or sitting with some of our program folks overseas. Our intern program can be anything from 4 to 9 months dependent on what we're trying to achieve with it. And it's hammered out with our HR team and the individual university.
And can I ask you there as well, we were very much struck, we were talking about there, say, the goal mile and just, I suppose, the symmetry between us and our local communities and being a community, doing things like that, serving other communities, you know, in another country, maybe a country we don't understand, don't even know, but we know need our help, you know, and we don't have to know anything too deeply to appreciate the purpose then for it. You know, you're just helping another human being somewhere else on the planet, and that can be just good enough for people, you know, and they trust then that you'll spend it wisely on their behalf. Can I ask you, though, I was just thinking about that we're kind of, you know, a very globally connected world. You know, has the profile of your donor, like, you know, shaped and gone, you know, kind of gone more global? Because I'm just thinking, you know, originally it obviously would have been very much sourced locally from people in Ireland, you know, that they were filling the coffers. But do you find yourself kind of in a much more expanded marketplace there? Obviously, you're competing with other NGOs, I understand that. But is there opportunity in that for you?
Of course. Goal today, the headquarters is here in Dunleary. We have, we're constituted, we have a team of people in London, in the UK, and we have a base in the US. And so our donor profile comes largely from those three geographies, but we have supporters, be they trusts or foundations, from all over the world. The MasterCard Foundation, based in Canada, is a very significant donor for our really innovative programming work in northern Uganda. That's very exciting for us. Often a trust or a foundation that's spearheaded by a family or a corporation will have its particular interest, and if we can match that, that's a great synergy. So our donors come from all over the world. The United States government is a key donor to us. Our program in Northwest Syria is very important. It's critical and it's large. We have over 1,000 staff almost 1,000 staff, I think, in Syria itself right now. Because it's a large program supporting those communities, and that's largely funded to a great degree by, you know, government donors, because this is a critical conflict for our generation, and that's a large expenditure. But you're correct. We probably have 40 or 50 different individual institutional donors, and they're from all over the world. And they bring, as I say, they bring us into new, some donors say, we only want to support you if you're doing something innovative and sustainable and can go to scale. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a foundation that's really helped so many NGOs push their boundaries and think about scale and think about how can we do more with what we have and make sure it's sustainable. I just want to call out the Gates Foundation for really pushing that agenda in our sector. So different donors are bringing, you know, new challenges and new opportunities. So it's an exciting space to be in for fundraisers, for communicators. How do you manage all of those stakeholders and keep people connected with your mission? I mean, becoming business-like and making sure that the business aligns with all of its statutory and legal requirements, from the protection of staff to the protection of donor money, the protection of communities, making sure all those things are in line, but don't interfere with communicating the essential purpose of what we're trying to achieve, which is work in solidarity with communities as they emerge from a crisis into a resilient livelihood. So that's the complexity.
It's fascinating, you know. I think, and I suppose it's that thing, you know, that, you know, that donors, you know, will say, we'll support that, my money must go to that program, you know what I mean, because that's what's in line with our values and our sense of purpose. So it is increasingly complex, but as you said, the complexity can drive on, you know, your the development of your own organization, because as you said, it pushes the boundaries, because you know, different donors will come back at you and say, listen, this is how we can fund you, but we need this to be scaled up. It can't be a micro project, you know. So that's fantastic. Just before we finish up, we always ask our listeners for any top tips they might have. Now, you've given us so many. I know it's kind of hard to maybe pick out, but for anyone, say, in college at the moment, whether they're a returner like you were at one stage, you know, maybe coming back and doing a master's part-time, or maybe at that undergraduate stage of life, or maybe even considering a career transition, because you mentioned earlier on that you transitioned into, say, work within the Irish healthcare system, but maybe there's somebody out there that's maybe in, you know, pharma or in an organization or in, you know, and would might be thinking, oh, I might want to transfer over into NGO. Like, what would be your top tips for anyone considering a career at whatever stage of life they're in right now about moving into GOAL or the NGO sector in general?
Okay, well, I'm going to borrow something from you, Siobhan.
Along the way,
you were saying, you know, the staying clear on your values and your purpose. And so I'd encourage folks, certainly young people, to reflect on, you know, it's never too early to ask yourself, what do I want to leave this world? What do I want to leave? What's going to be my legacy? It's not too early. It's not too early to ask yourself that in college. But I also don't want to at all give the impression that the only way of experiencing or expressing that is through something like the NGO world. Your purpose and your mission and your values can be expressed through any single space you find yourself, as long as, you know, you bring that vision and that mission and you articulate it and you call it out when you see people. You know, we had International Women's Day recently, and the whole agenda was around, I will call out oppression, discrimination of women when I see it in any space I see it. And so you don't have to work for an NGO to be purpose driven. But so my first top tip is your top tip is, you know, think about your values and ask yourself, you know, how do I live those? Another top tip for me, I'm just looking at sort of the competencies that I look at on an interview board. You know, we ask everybody, have you lived in difficult circumstances? Tell us about a difficulty you've had. We need to know that if somebody's traveling abroad with us, that they will not be cowed by the complexity they encounter by different cultures. So one way of achieving that is by traveling cheap, traveling, you know, in foreign lands, exotic spaces, and asking yourself, am I self-reliant enough to make it through here? So, you know, we look for that as a competency, people who can live and who have traveled and who understand themselves in difficult circumstances. I would say, and I think I mentioned this, it was hugely formative for me to take my passion and even my experience abroad and put that through the rigors of a master's in international relations and be challenged on some of my own preconceived notions. So, you know, continuous learning is something that we really would always be looking for in a candidate. I met somebody recently who told me they're only taking the people who got a first in their master's into the interviews. And I said, well, we don't do that at all. We look for people who are well-rounded. We look for people who can manage adversity in their life. We ask the question, I always ask it, tell me about a time it didn't go right. And what did you learn? And what do you do differently now? Because it's a facade to say trajectories, particularly career trajectories of seasoned professionals have been straight.
No.
They have, you know, there's difficulties. It would be wrong for me to pretend that, and it's not a good sign at an interview if somebody does pretend it. So we always ask, talk about adversity and talk about your capacity to learn. And the final thing is, you know, do what you can do to manage your own, you know, your own well-being. you know, COVID has taught us so much, and I'm sure no one will thank me for talking about mental health and well-being, but we really want to see that people take their own mental well-being and their personal resilience seriously. The workplace can be hard. This year we've changed, and last year we've changed in ways we never thought we would. And we've been really concerned to make sure that we support our staff who are coping with childcare, elder care, and lives, you know, shaped in a way and lived in a way they never thought. So we really want people to be able to talk about when they're struggling and be able to know where to look and be brave enough to know where to look. So a couple of just key things about staying in the workplace. It can be tough. And so just that personal self-management is something you're never too early to ask yourself, you know, is there more I could be doing here in terms of my personal self-care and my ability to recognize when I'm stretched and how I manage that? So I'd say those are my top tips.
Fantastic. Listen, Mary, it's just been absolutely amazing. You're very inspirational, and it's not only inspirational, but you've backed it up using back one of your own words, evidence. You brought evidence to play here in everything that you spoke about today. You supported it with evidence, and that is hugely, hugely powerful. And thank you so much for giving of your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Siobhan.